Senate State Affairs is called to order. Today is Tuesday, April 9th, 2019. Let the record reflect the time is 3:47 p.m. Today we have President, Senator Reinbold, Senator Machicki, Senator Kawasaki, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, myself, Chair Schauer. I'd like to remind everyone to please go ahead and silence or turn off your cell phones. Staff assisting us today, we've got Carrie up front with Senate Records, and we have Nate at the LAO and Jake assisting from the office. Three items on today's agenda, and that's going to be SB 92, PFD contributions to the general fund, an initial rollout of SB 10, extend suicide prevention council, and hopefully get back to SB 32, crime, sentencing, mental illness, evidence from rules requests by the governor. First, we're going to bring back up SB 92, PFD contributions to the general fund. We last heard this bill on Thursday, April 4th, and since open and closed public testimony, members should have the proposed CS for this bill in front of them. And I'm going to go ahead and ask Vice Chair Coghill to make a motion to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt for our working document the CS for Senate Bill Number 92, State Affairs, version 31-LS0703M as our working document.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. I'm going to go ahead and object for the purposes of discussion. I'm going to ask Senator Wilson and or staff, if you'd like it, to come up to the table and walk us through the explanation of changes.
Thank you, Chair Schauer. For the record, my name is Davis Wilson, Senator for District D, and with me today is...
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson.
The committee substitute for Senate Bill 92, the purpose of this CS is to clarify the intent of the bill. Our office has already gotten calls with people a little upset about the whole pick, click, give the confusion already, even though that's not the intent of the bill. This removes the language from AS 43.23.130 of the statute dealing with pick, click, give, and adds a new section of law, then 43.23.135, contributions to the general fund, creating a mechanism for donation to the general fund. Title 43 is our revenue and taxation statute, and Chapter 23 deals with permanent fund dividends. The amendment arose with a discussion with the drafter to help and the department to help clarify the intent. That clarifies that creates a separate button for mechanic, separate button and a mechanics, I cannot talk today, and a system of the pick, click, give of the dividend application, and the intent and is not intended to compete with any charitable donations of the pick, click, give program. Again, we're not trying to compete with any charitable givings of the pick, click, give program. So the explanation of changes from version A to version M. In section 1, this removes all material from page 1, line through 3, through page 3, line 6, is all deleted, and is replaced with this new section of law, section AS 43.23.135, contributions to the general fund. Part A defines the parameters of the increments contributing to the general fund, establishes donations through the pick, click, give to take priority over donations to the general fund if there's a shortfall, meaning if someone donates too much in the general fund and also donates pick, click, give, that difference, pick, click, give, a charitable contribution will take priority in that giving. It requires a 7% administration fee, similar to pick, click, give, to help fund this program. Part B notes that the public agency that claims the dividend cannot donate on the general behalf. So if you have a guardianship of someone else, you can't donate on that person's behalf to the general fund. A program similar to what OCS, if someone else is in a child in custody, you can't donate that. That's already in statute. So we just wanted to clarify that, trying to make sure we protect our vulnerable individuals in that. And Part C explicitly states this is separate from the pick, click, give button and the dividend application process. And that is all the changes.
Okay. I will remove my objection at this time. And does the committee have questions for Senator Wilson? That leaves the adopted CS before us at this time. So my intention is to move the bill. Is there any final discussion from any of the committee members? Senator Coghill, I think, was first.
Yeah, thank you. This still is a dividend that they end up having to pay the tax on, right? So there's no escaping that particular portion of this, right?
Not at this time. There was that conversation, I believe, last year through a former legislator, had that legislative opinion, which were distributed to, I think, committee members. Maybe. But again,
like at ease. At ease. On the record, Senator Wilson, if you want to continue with that, please.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, there was lots of debate upon how to try to make this non-taxable and do that, and it's difficult. It's not an easy, simple solution to do that, and that was the concept of that alleged legal memo that Representative Lascara had drafted up last year. We also confirmed with them again this year, similar language of the complexities in that, but once someone applies for a dividend, uses that dividend on our current system, it becomes a taxable item. And we would tell you to please refer to your tax attorney, tax representative, professional on how best to withhold your potential tax earnings and donate the access of your taxable amount, which is the recommendation.
Sir,
I just wanted to make it clear because we're having a whole new language set, and I want to make sure that is still the understanding as people move forward. Other than that, I know this has a finance referral, and I'm not going to bring up any other questions. I appreciate the fact that you've taken care of the Picklick Give conundrum, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rumble, I think, was first had a question.
Okay, so first of all, I do support the statutory PFD. And I think because the state has the mineral rights to the subsurface rights, that's the dividend that Alaskans get. And so I think it's just really important to never forget. That's the reason Alaskans get a dividend. And most of my district, I think, would rather have other people, you know, develop the minerals and resources below the land and then they get a dividend. But if not, they want their mineral rights. You know, so that's basically the defend the permanent fund dividend. Those people are in my district, that big group. That's mine. So it's really important that I keep an eye on the dividend. But I think this bill is an excellent opportunity for so many others. I've been to a lot of town halls, and the other ones were like, take my permanent fund dividend and tax me. And they're typically teachers or public employees from what I've seen. So I think this is a great opportunity because instead of us taking it, the government taking it, they're allowed to give it. And so I think this was actually a brilliant idea. I really, really like it. And a lot of them said they want to pay taxes too. So, you know, then it's a win-win for them. They can give their dividend and they can pay taxes that they all claim that, or so many of them claim that they want to do, but yet those that really need it, I know it paid for my college, you know, so I think the permanent dividend is a really great program. And the seniors, I think it really impacts the seniors taking the permanent fund dividend and the youth especially. It's a huge tax on youth and elderly. So I think this is a really great compromise and a super good opportunity, and I'm very supportive and I'll probably be a sponsor on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Rambo. I don't think there was a question, though. So.
No, you said no comments.
We didn't. No, it's good. I was just making sure because I think it was looking like there was a question. I didn't get one, so no worries.
We had questions earlier.
It's okay. David was looking expectantly. I'm like, okay. Senator Michicki up. I wasn't throwing a spear.
Yeah, I also don't have a question, Mr. Chairman. I have two papers from the questions I asked, and one was about whether or not it could be tax-free. It looks like it could be. I support this moving on. I think it's something we want to put some thought into, and there's a couple of methods of doing that here, and it also says that you absolutely could donate to the public education fund or other fund if you chose to do that, which would give it a little bit more of a fiscal note, but it may also help direct some of those donations to some of the things that people believed in. The reason I'm asking about the tax-free status is if you're going to be taxed, I'd like for people to use this. And if you're going to be taxed anyway, you may as well take the check and donate it to your kids' PTA or some other direct contribution as opposed to giving it to the general fund. So that's the reason I'm asking about that. If you don't take the money, it looks from these memorandums from legal services that it's possible to set it up in a way where they wouldn't be taxed because they would never receive the check. So I'll be looking at that as we get into finance and see. Again, I think it's a good idea, but I'd like for it to be fully utilized. And I know myself, who already donates to our schools in my district, I would use it if I weren't going to be taxed on it. But if I were going to be taxed, I would contribute directly. So looking for a way for it to be fully utilized and for folks not to send 30% of that dividend to the federal government. I'd like to keep it here in the state. So those are my concerns, and we'll deal with it a little bit in finance.
Indeed we will.
See if there's a solution.
Thank you for that. And I'll just add my comments to it because it doesn't look like anybody else had them. I agree with Senator Reinbold on the, you know, if you talked about the numbers of public testimony we had and you extrapolate that out, I was doing math and put it out in social media, which is always dangerous. But, you know, between $400 to $500 million. I would expect to see based on public testimony that people were to give their dividends back, and that's a significant bump into the treasury for the things we're trying to solve. That's not maybe the long-term solution, but it is an interesting part of the solution to go, hey, if you really want to donate, here's your chance. And I think that that is a good option to give maybe in the interim while we're figuring out our way ahead. So I support this as well. I think it's a good idea, and we ought to get this passed through the House, have the governor sign it. Hopefully that will happen. So at this time, Senator Wilson, you have any follow-up comments before closing, I should say?
No, Mr. Chair, just that one of your committee members and I have had conversations upon how they may have had this idea, and I'm not saying that we stole the idea. I think we just had it from two different directions and met at the bridge at the same time.
So. Fair enough. Okay. At this time, it doesn't look like there's any final discussion. Seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and ask Vice Chair Senator Coghill to make a motion to move the bill out of committee, please.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate State Affairs Committee move Senate Bill 92 as the committee substitute for Senate Bill 92 version M from committee with the attached fiscal notes.
All right, and seeing and hearing no objections, CS for SB 92 has moved from committee. Thank you, Senator Wilson. I'm going to take a brief of these to sign paperwork.
Restate the motion so that it's more clear. That I move the Senate State Affairs Committee substitute for Senate Bill 92 version M with individual recommendations and with fiscal notes forthcoming.
Thank you, Senator Cogger. We're going to go back off the record sign. We'll be right back.
Any objections?
Good point. Thank you. Are there any objections? Seeing and hearing none, we're going to get it right and go off the record. We'll be right back.
Coming back to order, we're going to get an initial rollout of SB 10, Extend Suicide Prevention Council, by Senator Kawasaki.
Senator Kawasaki is going to walk us through the bill, and we'll hear from Ms. Chris Curtis with Legislative Audit and the Executive Director for the Suicide Prevention Council, Ms. Bev Schoonover, under invited testimony. After that, we're going to open up public testimony, and then we'd like to make the committee aware there are lifelines for the bill as we're going through it in the audience and online, Legislative Audit, Suicide Prevention Council, Department of Education, Health and Social Services. With that, Senator Kawasaki, if you could please place your name on the record and begin the walkthrough, please.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 10 is a real simple bill with a real impactful purpose. Senate Bill 10 extends the termination date of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. As you know, and there's folks who have been in the building in the last 2 weeks or so for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, to talk about suicide as an issue and to make sure that talking about it is an important structure to help correct the issues that we have. In Alaska, in the United States, there's roughly 12 suicides per 100,000. In Alaska, those numbers are roughly double at 23 per 100,000. If you're an Alaska Native male, that number is 52 per 100,000. And for a representative who represents a military base, and of course you can recognize this, that if you serve in the armed services, you're twice as likely to commit suicide than just a civilian American. These are startling statistics. We've unfortunately gone a little bit behind and backwards. According to the Department of Health and Social Services Department of Epidemiology, suicide rates in Alaska have increased by 13% in the last 5 years, making suicide the leading cause of death for Alaskans between the age of 10 and 64. As a matter of public health, the state has a responsibility to address this issue and this disturbing trend, and we must actively continue to pursue strategies to prevent suicide in Alaska. One thing that the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council does, they do many things according to Statute 4438350. They're responsible for advising us as legislators on ways, and the governor, on ways to improve Alaskans' health and wellness when it comes to reducing suicide. They improve public awareness of suicide and risk factors, enhance suicide prevention efforts. They work with partners such as faith-based organizations and communities and local governments. And create a statewide suicide prevention plan and put it in action. The council holds public meetings, publishes a five-year state suicide prevention plan, and works with schools and community groups to provide resources. If you turn to the fiscal note, you'll see that it's a rather large fiscal note. One of the reasons is because the council is partnered with the Alaska Community Foundation and the Alaska Children's Trust to continue the GCI Suicide Prevention Grant Program. Nine grants were awarded last year, in 2017, totaling over $100,000. The council also helped secure funding for a five-year grant from the National Institute for Mental Health to create the Alaska Native Collaboration Hub for Resilience Research. We're hoping that with continued service of this council and its leadership, that we can reduce suicide within our state and get us back down to much, much lower numbers that we all hope to get. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. We're going to go ahead and ask. Actually, we have a question, so we'll go ahead and answer some questions for the sponsor, Senator Machicki.
Actually, I don't have a question. Although it's a legislative appointment, I serve as one of the legislative reps on the Suicide Prevention Council, and just wanted to state that for the record.
Okay, thank you. But that being said, that's important work. Do you have anything that might be benefit for the discussion as we talk about this and why it's important, how it matters?
Well, there's no question that we support the extension of the council. We have a serious issue. I think Senator Kawasaki covered it well. We've just recently here in Juneau, experienced a fairly public suicide, and I have a staff member that lost his brother just within the last couple of weeks. I mean, it's a very serious issue. When you look at the climb from 14 until now, I mean, there's obviously economic factors, but we have a lot of work to do, and the council does excellent work on hopefully forwarding that cause and hoping to understand the issues or we can support Alaskans and dramatically reduce that rate in our state. So I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. You'll find Senator Kawasaki and I have discussed this quite a bit. I mean, being a veteran myself, I know Senator Coghill as well. and I don't know the current number. I'd have to look at it, but I know at the peak we were hitting about 22 a day for veterans, nearly one an hour. Some of our best and brightest young kids have seen things they shouldn't have to see as human beings, and it's very hard to reintegrate in society. So you add that on top of just normal life, relationships, problems, financial things, and then you come back from war and the things you've seen, and how do you integrate into that? And so it's very difficult. And whatever we can do to help people that are struggling, this is one that I wholeheartedly support. And I think it's critical for us to make sure that we're reaching out to people, because you could add law enforcement, first responders, and others to that too, because they struggle with the same kinds of things that they see. So this is something I think as a society we owe that kind of help to the people that are stepping up, and just that's above and beyond the average person that's just dealing with life and the problems they have. Did anybody else have something they wanted to add to that right now? I mean, let's make it crystal clear. I support this as we go through it. We have Chris Curtis. Make sure I've got on the line here. Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking outside. My bad. Sorry. Would you like to come up and go through this, please, Chris? My apologies. I'm stuck on the iPad now. Please put yourself on the record and provide testimony.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. I believe you all have a copy of the audit in your packets dated August of 2018. So the purpose of a sunset audit is to determine whether a board, commission, or in this case a council, is serving the public's interest and whether it should be extended. So overall, we found the council operated in the public's interest by actively broadening the public's awareness of suicide prevention and coordinating the efforts of other suicide prevention entities, such as state agencies, regional groups, coalitions, and local communities. Additionally, the council fulfilled its statutory duty by issuing the 2018 through 2022 Suicide Prevention Plan and working closely with stakeholders to add and refine the plan's strategies, resources, and indicators. We are recommending the 8-year extension for this council, which is the maximum allowed for in statute. If you turn to page 4 of your audit, you will see a schedule of expenditures and funding sources. This shows that the council is completely funded by general fund appropriations, and it shows that in FY18, the council expended just under $600,000. If you turn to pages 9 and 10 of the audit, this list provides a detailed listing of council activities held during the audit period, and you can see that this council is very active. We do have two recommendations for improvements. They begin on page 12. These are administrative in nature and should be easily addressed. Recommendation number one, we recommend the council's executive director develop and implement procedures to ensure public notices for meetings are published timely and accurately. We found 5 of 18 meetings held from July of 2014 through March of 2018 were not public noticed or not public noticed properly. The deficiencies were caused by a lack of written procedures. Recommendation number two, also on page 12, we recommend the council chair develop and implement procedures to ensure performance evaluations are completed annually for the council's executive director. Statutes require the evaluation be performed annually. We found that there should have been 4 evaluations during the audit period, and there were only 2 completed. And it was unclear why the evaluations did not take place. So responses to the audit begin on page 23. Both the Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner and the Council Chair agree and concur with the report's conclusions and recommendations.
Okay. Do we have questions, Senator Cargo?
Thank you for the audit and the concise. Chris, in doing the evaluations, they were doing them properly, just not timely. Is that the deal?
Yes, to the chair, that is correct.
Right. And then was there any extenuating circumstances on the notice that you could find?
Through the chair, if you're referring to the public notices, right. To the chair, no. It was simply an oversight by staff and not doing them correctly.
Okay. And it looks like in their responses that they're going to go ahead and fix those, and like you said, relatively easy administrative fixes. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Do we have further questions for Chris? Thank you for coming up and testifying. I'll ask Ms. Schoonover, with the executive director for the Suicide Prevention Council, to please come to table to speak. And this time, you're not on the iPad. Please put yourself on the record and provide testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Beverly Schoonover. I'm the acting director of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. Thank you for your consideration of Senate Bill 10 to extend the work of the council to 2027. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council was established by the legislature in 2001 and serves as an advisory council to the legislature and governor regarding suicide awareness and prevention. There are 13 volunteer members of the council that are appointed by the governor and 4 ex officio members appointed by the legislature. We have 1 staff, Eric Morrison, who's a project assistant. He's been with the council for many years. Senator Kawasaki went over the duties of the council, but just in general, most of the council's activities involve collaboration between stakeholders, supporting outreach and educational programs through the suicide awareness, prevention, and postvention grant program, advocating for federal and local funding, and providing technical assistance as needed. One example of our statewide coordination efforts was the completion of the 5-year State of Alaska Suicide Prevention Plan entitled Recasting the Net, Promoting Wellness to Prevent Suicides in Alaska. Thanks to extensive public input and stakeholder collaboration, hundreds of Alaskans from all over the state participate in the creation of this plan. The number one goal of this plan is that Alaskans accept responsibility for preventing suicide. And so what does that mean? We believe that everyone in Alaska has been touched by suicide. So it's the responsibility of all Alaskans to work together to prevent suicide and work to reduce and address the risk of suicide statewide. And that's really what this council does. We bring people together to talk about suicide, to evaluate what prevention efforts work, to advise agencies, the governor, and the legislature on how we can promote wellness and reduce suicide in Alaska. We coordinate state agencies and other entities so they can work together more effectively to prevent suicide. And while there are other governmental and private sector agencies that have a common goal on the prevention of suicide, no other organization performs the statewide coordinator function. We definitely have more work to do, and we ask that you extend the council's work so that we can all continue to coordinate statewide efforts for suicide prevention. Thank you, Senator Kawasaki, for your leadership on this bill, and Senator Coghill and Senator Machicki for supporting this bill and sponsoring this bill. And thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Bev, for coming forward today and testifying. You'll see my name added to that list. Unfortunately, I've just been a little lax by not getting it on the floor. Hopefully, it's been crystal clear that in my status as a 24-year veteran, I support this unequivocally. So this work will never end, unfortunately. So thank you for taking the time to come in today.
Thank you.
All right, this time we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony for the bill. We have some folks online. And what we're going to do is have my staff member behind me time us. We're going to just look for 2 minutes or less as you jump into. There are a few people in the room and those that are online. So we're going to go ahead and start with, we have the Fairbanks LIO. We have Devin Doss online. I hopefully have that correctly. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am. When you're ready, please put yourself on the record with your name and provide your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Devin Das. I have lived in Fairbanks for 35 years, during which I served at the University of Alaska Fairbanks as a professor of mechanical engineering. My wife has suffered from mental illness for about 40 years. Therefore, I have been a volunteer at NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, to help her, to help myself, and to help many others who are in similar situation. Medical research has shown that mental illness and suicides are very closely linked. I have experienced that in my family. When mental illness episode has increased, the chances of suicide also increases. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, SSPC, leads in this effort to help the people of Alaska, help the state policymakers. It helps to improve health and wellness of Alaskans. It enhances public awareness of suicide and outlines the risk factors, and it provides guidance to governors and legislators. From all these studies, it is found that suicide is preventable. By treating the mental illness, we can reduce suicide. Therefore, as a board member of NAMI Fairbanks, I support SB 10. SB 10 will extend the sunset date of SSPC to 2027, and this bill is also supported by NAMI Alaska. I thank legislators, including Senator Kawasaki, who attended the candlelight visit, which was hosted by ASPC on Capitol steps recently on March 26th. We NAMI representatives were also there. We all stood together on Capitol steps. Let us now join hands to pass this bill. I want the legislators to support Senate Bill 10 to extend the SSPC to 2027. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you, Devin, for taking the time to call in this afternoon. We're going to switch now to Juno in the room. It looks like we've got a few that would like to testify signed up. We've got Jane Andreen from the AKA Public Health Association. Hope I got your last name right.
You did.
Yes, ma'am. When you're ready, put yourself on the record and provide testimony, please.
My name is Jane Andreen. I live in Douglas, and I'm here representing the Alaska Public Health Association. We are a 150-member-plus organization, statewide association of public and behavioral health professionals, and we are strongly in support of extending the Suicide Prevention Council. You've heard the statistics. We don't need to go through them, but it's vitally important, as you have heard, for Alaska to have a central council that can be coordinating and collaborating on these issues. We also strongly support the fiscal note that's attached. I'm especially excited to hear about and promote the research project that's happening, because this is such a deep, entwined problem that we need to really better understand to be able to make effective change. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am, for coming in this afternoon to testify. And we have one more in the room, so we're going to go ahead and try to take care of that. We've got Sam Trevette. The Juno Suicide Prevention Council. Yes, sir. Go ahead and put yourself on the record. Provide testimony, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sam Trivett. I am here on behalf of the Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition, and also for myself. I've been a resident of Alaska continuously for 65 years now. I've lived, worked, and volunteered all around the state for over 57 years. I've been involved with the Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition for over 11 years now, and been involved with the council for 10 out of those 11 years. I personally, my wife and I, have participated in a number of statewide conferences, regional conferences, and trainings with the council and with other partners all around the state. The council has linked us to some extremely valuable national experts and resources that we would not have known about otherwise. We have gotten together with other members of coalitions around the state. And I agree with you, Senator. It's always going to be here. But what we've got to do is reduce the numbers. And I personally am extremely happy to be here today. This is at least the third session I've testified to continue the council. The first time I testified, the audit was recommending abolish it. And I talked to senators and representatives during committee about the need for the council, how things had changed over the last year since the report was done. There are a lot of positive signs. It sounds like the bill's being supported, but I'm heartened that, for example, the care line, which is run out of Fairbanks, statewide care line, Alaska's own crisis line, has almost quadrupled the number of people calling in recent years. What that tells you, senators, is that people are beginning to open up and be willing to reach out. And that itself is tremendously positive. The council has been funding a program to improve the programs in the schools, a key problem. We certainly have had some young people deaths in the schools. And they have developed a model over the last couple of years that is superb. I just spent a day with the council when they were here in Juneau recently, saw the presentation, talked to the people who have made those positive changes, and that information is now going out to all the school districts in Alaska. And I'm extremely happy that I think they're doing a better job than we've ever done. And so I urge you to support it, and thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for coming in, Sam, testifying this afternoon. And I agree with you, the need is going to be there for a long time. Yes, and people that think it's not, my oldest son, time in Iraq and infantry in the Marines,
right.
And of many of the platoons he served with, some of those platoons have had half of their squad mates in one platoon commit suicide coming back from that region of Afghanistan, Iraq. The need is there, and it's happened recently even here at home amongst our servicemen and women. So it will be around for a long time. Thank you.
We are making progress, though.
You bet. Thank you. We have now on off-net, we're going to switch over to, we've got Barbara Franks in the Nilchik, the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. Barbara, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Please go ahead, ma'am, 2 minutes, and put yourself on the record with your name and provide your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Barbara Franks, and I am with the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, and I also am connected with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, former NAMI board, former API board, and I bring those to the forefront because I'm taking those hats off, and the seat that I feel with the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council is a mother of a child who died by suicide. That was December 14, 1997. 2 days later, my husband of 25 years died of cancer on December 16, 1997. Then there were no 1-800 numbers to call. Then there weren't any websites to look at. Then there weren't any books to open up and see what to do next. How do you respond to someone in your family who has thoughts of suicide? I'm glad that the people who have spoke before me are from different entities because it shows that we are working together. It shows that we are following the National Strategic Plan, and we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We're not trying to compete with each other because we need each other. That National Suicide Prevention Lifeline brought in 2,224,408 people in the United States. And I connect this all together because it's our young people from Alaska that are living in different states that are telling other people about that number. There is a place. You're not alone. And so as we follow the National Strategic Plan, and we reach out to others. We're reaching out not only to the policemen, but their wives. We're not only reaching out to the clergy, but to their wives. We're reaching out to the people who are cleaning up our beds in our rooms as we travel, because they also have people they care about, too. Thank you for listening, and I appreciate your concern for the extension.
Thank you, Barbara, for taking the time to call on this afternoon. We're going to switch now over to Sharon Fischel in Juneau. Sharon, can you hear us? Sharon, if you're with us, if you can take your phone off and mute, although I think that may be you now. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name and provide your testimony, please.
Hi, my name is Sharon Fischel. I am an education specialist with the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. I am the staff that oversees the school-based suicide prevention services, and I'm just here to answer any questions that people may have.
Sharon, this is I kind of missed the very last part there where you completed for questions. I apologize. My staff came up with a note right as you were finishing. Does anyone have questions for Ms. Fischel? Sharon, thank you for taking the time to call in this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
We're going to switch now to Monique Andrews in Eagle River. It looks like you are representing yourself. Monique, go ahead and put yourself on the record who you represent. Provide your testimony, please.
Hi, my name is Monique Andrews, and I'm calling in from Eagle River. And I'm representing myself, although I am a member of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, but I wanted to call today and testify as a mother. And as a member of the Alaska Army National Guard, the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council is responsible for collaboration throughout the state for suicide prevention efforts, as you've heard. And the what is relevant to me about the efforts of the council is that many of the collaboration efforts occur with focusing on the most vulnerable population in our state, which is our youth. Our youth rates, as someone stated earlier, for the leading cause of death for individuals from age 10 to 65 was suicide. The efforts of the council are instrumental in ensuring prevention services continue for our most vulnerable population, our youth. It's relevant in many, 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 many ways, not just because we want children to get resiliency skills, but these children who grow up to then join the military, who then join the Alaska National Guard, we want them to be as equipped as we can for them to take on that huge responsibility of protecting our state and protecting our great country. That is only done through efforts starting early. With many of the grants that the council oversees being used in the education system, you have programs like the You Are Not Alone program. You have other peer support programs. Just as the gentleman spoke about the educational classes that are being taught to provide resiliency skills. So I support the council on being a mother, as someone who has a child in school who needs to learn resiliency from all sides, not just at home, but at school from his teacher. We all need to be talking the same language, because eventually he may decide he wants to join the military, and I want him fully equipped to take on the responsibility of protecting this state with as much resiliency skills as he possibly can have. Thank you for an opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Monique, for calling in this afternoon. We're going to switch over to James Biella from Newtuck. If you can hear us, please put yourself on the line, who you represent, and 2 minutes, personal testimony. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is James Biella. I'm the lead field advocate for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, the Alaska chapter, and I had the privilege of meeting quite a few of you a couple of weeks ago when I brought down advocates down to Juneau. The casting the net upstream is very unique to Alaska Endeavor with the Suicide Prevention Council. It's aligned with the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention and also the American Indian and Alaska Native National Suicide Prevention Strategy Plan. It's also aligned with our goal with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention by reducing suicide by at least 20% by 2025. I've had the privilege of partnering with the council since the chapter was formed in 2010. We have the same goals. Although the Alaska rates have increased by 13%, it should be also noted that the national rate has also increased by 30%. The military rates, as stated earlier, was 22. It's down. Kind of good side is 20 now. I've had the privilege of working with the Council at Elder and Youth, where they've assisted me in the last 6 years in presenting suicide prevention as well as healing to the audience at Elder and Youth. We've shared booths right next to each other instead of on the opposite halls, but now we are close together working as a team. The council has also increased the participation in AFSP, the International Survivor of Suicide Loss Day, on Saturday before Thanksgiving. AFSP strongly encourages the continuation of statewide suicide prevention council. We have to work as a team, and all the organizations need to come together with one council. I want to thank everybody in Juneau for their participation and support for Senate Bill 10, the continuation of statewide suicide prevention council. Thank you.
Thank you, James, for taking time to call in this afternoon. We have one more caller. We have Brenda Moore from the Alaska Mental Health Board in Anchorage. Brenda, if you can hear us, thanks for your patience. Go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name and provide your testimony, please.
Hi, this is Brenda Moore. I thank you very much for taking time to hear public comments on this important legislation. I am the current chair of the Alaska Mental Health Board, and I am serving in the seat for the Alaska Mental Health Board on the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, and I have been there for quite a while now and have seen the council move from not as evidence-based and not as well organized to a place where we now really have some momentum. When I first began on the council, suicide prevention awareness was not very well understood, and especially when it came to our tribal organizations. We began partnering through our representative on the council to the Federation, Alaska Federation of Natives, and began to hold a summit, and then we held a statewide summit in conjunction with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. These summits resulted in regional state suicide prevention coalitions that are very active in their region, and the council works to monitor and collaborate and coordinate with what they are doing. We work very closely with the Division of Behavioral Health with their prevention grantees. And as you heard, Monique is on our council. It wasn't too long ago when we realized that veterans and military personnel were the suicide rate was rising in that population. And we came before the legislature and asked to add a representative seat for the military on our council. We work, as you've heard, very closely in building partnerships and collaboration so that we can help coordinate and ensure that there's a framework for how suicide is spoken about and how it's promoted, the strategies that are promoted, and our work got off to kind of a slow start, but we have quite a momentum, I feel now, and I am thankful to Senator Kawasaki for sponsoring this the bill to extend the council, and I strongly urge you to support that bill.
Thank you, Brenda, for taking the time to call in this afternoon. Do we have anybody else in the room that we have missed that would like to testify on Senate Bill 12? And seeing no one else that's called in online, I'm going to close public testimony at this time. We're going to take it at ease. Senate State Affairs back on the record. Is there any final discussion on Senate Bill 12? Seeing and hearing none, it's my intent we're going to go ahead and move the bill from committee today. So I'm going to make or ask my Vice Chair, Senator Cock, to make a motion. Did I say 12? My apologies for the record. Thank you for the catch. I think I did that once on the floor as well earlier this session. Had the wrong note passed to me. So Senate Bill 10, to be clear on the intent. I'm going to ask Vice Chair Senator Coghill to make a motion to move the bill from committee, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move the Senate Bill number 10, version A, with the attached fiscal note and recommendations as we will.
Seeing no objections, Senate Bill 10 has moved from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease, sign the paperwork. We're going to go ahead and bring back up now Senate Bill 32, Crime Sentencing Mental Illness Evidence. The last committee last heard this bill last Thursday, April 4th. Thursday, we'll be getting a more in-depth look at the bill as well, and we're going to continue to have other agencies on board, like the Public Defender and the Criminal Justice Commission, available to speak to the bill. We do have other agencies here today to ask the list of questions that have been provided, and there may be more as we go. For today, we do have Department of Law, Corrections, and Public Safety in the room, and online available to ask questions. We have members from Law, Public Safety, as well as, like I said, those that are in the room with us here. We have Rob Henderson on the line from Department of Law, and we've got two from Public Safety. We've got Michael Duxbury, Deputy Commissioner, and Kathy Monfrida from DPS. There should have in front of you a list of questions that were prepared by Senator Kawasaki, if you'd like to look at those for the members. And at this time, we're going to just begin with the questions and start digging on SB 32. As a reminder for everyone, we are judiciary as well on this particular bill because this goes directly to finance next, not from us for policy. So just setting that back on the record. And here we go. So the floor is open for discussions and questions. And who wants to start? We can pull up whoever we need to. Did you?
I think they were mailed to everybody.
They should be out there. Jake, can you grab a list of questions? That's it. You got it. That's the right one. He's got it, Jake.
All right, got it. It just didn't say his name on it. So.
Whoever wants to come up first.
Okay, well, how about Department of Law? We've got, might as well put them up here. There was the least questions, at least initially, for Department of Law. So we do have Mr. Henderson online, and we can start with him if you'd like. So, go ahead, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have the questions in front of you?
Rob, Mr. Henderson, can you put yourself on the record? And that question was directed for you.
Thank you, committee members. For the record, Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law. Senator Kawasaki, I do have a list of questions.
Okay.
So, are you going to start on Section 49?
Yeah, I guess I'll just reread the questions for folks that are watching.
Please, public record.
And so it's on record. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in Section 28, what's the average sentence? Oh, and if you don't have the numbers in front of you, that's fine. We can just get them in writing. I know some of it might take detailed work. But what was the average sentence length for disorderly conduct, both pre- and post-Senate Bill 91?
Through the chair, Senator, that is information that I do not have available. I believe, actually, that information may be available from the Department of Corrections. We're seeing if we can pull that information from our respective systems. I will tell you that pre-SB 91, the maximum term for disorderly conduct was 10 days, and so any sentence pre-SB 91 was under 10 days. The prior convictions and mitigators and aggravators did not change that maximum sentence. That maximum sentence was the top end of that. And then the same can be said for post-SB 91. Under the current law, the maximum term of imprisonment for disorderly conduct is 24 hours, regardless of how many prior convictions or whether there's mitigators or aggravators.
Sure. I guess, Mr. Chairman, just what I'm trying to get at is whether post-Senate Bill 91, I guess pre-Senate Bill 90, I'm trying to get an idea of what the total number of days for disorderly conduct would look like if it's extended back to 10 days. So that's just kind of what I'm getting at. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just in Section 32, I have a question. How was the threshold for 1A and 2A drug possessions determined? How did the department determine the threshold to show personal use versus intent?
Through the chair, Senator, the threshold for Schedule 1A and 2A drug were actually recommended by and proposed by the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission as part of their recommendation to the legislature in December of 2015. Initially, those amounts were 2.5 grams. Those amounts changed over the legislative process during legislative hearings in SB 91 to where it is now, which is trafficking in under 1 gram of a Schedule 1A controlled substance is a C felony, and trafficking in under 2.5 grams of a Schedule II drug is a C felony. If you're trafficking in more than that amount, that would be the B felony. The rationale, as listed in the Justice Reinvestment Report to the legislature, was that the changes to the drug laws were based on the conclusion that over the past 10 years prior to criminal justice reform, post-conviction admissions to prison for drug offenses had grown by 35%, and that felony drug offenders were spending longer amount of time in jail than they were 10 years ago. The commission determined that drug offenders that there was little evidence of a deterrent effect for drug offenders, and so the proposal really was to reduce the sentence available to drug offenders, and by reclassifying the drug trafficking of a 1A controlled substance from an A felony to either a B or a C based on the amount, and reclassifying drug trafficking of a Schedule 2A controlled substance from a B felony to a B or a C depending on the amount, it did reach its intended goal, which was reduce sentencing of and the available of prison terms available to drug traffickers. And when you combine that with then the reduction of presumptive sentencing across the board for most offenses, that also reduced the availability of prison and jail as a sanction for drug trafficking.
Okay. And before we go to the next question, just because I meant to ask him beforehand, but there was a Rob had deferred potentially to DOC with some of the data on the first question he asked. Did you have any follow-up data at this time? Okay. And just for those that are here between law, safety, Department of Corrections, I know we don't have all the answers yet, and that was forwarded ahead of time, but we're hoping to move this bill potentially by the end of next week if we can get to it. So I'd like to have those answers if we can get them from whichever agency. Thursday would be great if we can get them, and not later than next Tuesday, just so that we have time for amendments, et cetera. So I just want to tell everybody out there, and I think go ahead. Actually, I had a question from Senator Coggo first. Senator Coggo.
And this is for Mr. Henderson as well. I think I'll agree with you in part on it had as an intended effect on less charges, but I think also there was some discussion, if I remember correctly, about the charges that were filed and then bargained down prior to this, and so prior to the Senate Bill 91. So I think maybe we need to have a graph that shows those that were charged but convicted on the difference, and then maybe we can see how maybe that has changed under the laws we have it today, because I think we need to have a concept of where, if it was a failure, where it really failed. And if we go back, do we actually go back to another failure? And so, Rob, do you understand what I'm getting at there?
Through the chair, Senator, can you describe what you're looking for one more time? A graph showing the changes, but if I could have a little bit more description, I think.
Maybe I'll just give you an example. So we changed the possession and trafficking at different levels. But there was still a felony charge. Previous to that, the amounts were still felonies, but at a different level. How many prior to the Senate Bill 91 change were charged but plea bargained, for example, and how many were conviction, and how did that change under this? As you say, it sounds like you recognize that it might be in this successful in getting that down. But if we go back, do we go back to a felony charge bargained down to a misdemeanor again? Because I remember some of the discussion on that it was a charge given, but finally pled down to a misdemeanor. Do I make that more clear?
Through the chair, Senator, that is more clear. Thank you very much. That is information we can look for, identifying and pulling information that would include both the charge and then whether or not it was resolved at a lower charge, both for pre-SB 91 and post-SB 91, will be very difficult to get before Thursday or even Tuesday, but we can try.
Well, this, Mr. Chairman, this is going to finance. I think it's important that they get the look at, because the question is going to be in finance, what are we fixing? And if before we were bargaining things down to misdemeanors, and if we go into this world and we still end up in that, does the charge and a conviction still equate? And Rob, I'm not going to be on finance, but a couple of the folks here are. I think that's going to be helpful to you to make your case that, yes, we need to up these because we're not getting the convictions. But part of the discussion I remember in the commission, the Criminal Justice Commission, was that the bargaining down to misdemeanors was still pretty significant in what we did prior to Senate Bill 91. So I think you need to show how it was working before, how it doesn't work, how going back to it helps us get back to what you think is going to be better. And we need to see that in a chart or some kind of a demonstration.
Rob, can you help out Senator Coghill with that and get something along those lines of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I can. And Senator, you know, one thing I want to add to this discussion, because I think you bring up a very good point, is one component of what you'll see in the Department of Law's fiscal note, which is it's a positive fiscal note, and that is in part because we anticipate returning to the level of drug prosecution that existed prior to SB 91. And so one of the things I can provide for the committee for purposes of this discussion is that what we saw internally with the Department of Law is that between 2015 and 2017, so those the year before and the year after criminal justice reform, felony drug prosecutions dropped by approximately 70%. And that is in part for because we just didn't have the tools and the discretion necessary to really address some of the drug trafficking. That's also in part because of the consequence of having the possession offenses, which used to be a C felony, reduced to a misdemeanor. So those came off top and went down to the misdemeanor level. I believe you have Deputy Commissioner Duxbury on the phone, and I've heard Deputy Commissioner Duxbury describe this phenomenon with drug prosecution before, and I do believe it would be helpful to the committee to hear from him on that point if he's available.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be good, and maybe I could add another wrinkle to that question since Mr. Duxbury is going to be on, and that is we hear anecdotally from the police that it was the felony charge that helped them get the dealers from the possession. And once that didn't happen, so the prosecution rate may not be because you file the felony, but because a felony hangs over them. Can you probably put that into the mix of the question?
So that's either for Mr. Henderson or Deputy Commissioner Duxbury. If you'd like to take that one, I think he would defer to you.
Chair, this is Deputy Commissioner Michael Duxbury. Could you succinctly break out the two questions again for me? I was listening, but I want to make sure that I got what your meaning was and what you were looking for.
And thank you, for being available to answer questions. We're digging down into the changes of the 1A and 2A back to the felony level and the amount level. My question was, how many were bargained prior to Senate Bill 91 and not bargained because they didn't have the possession to hold over and get the other felony charges, if you understand. So we're trying to find out what was the problem. Was it the drug amount, or was it the felony charge on possession, and was that a police problem or a prosecution problem?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, it's a complicated issue, and I will try to answer it as succinctly as I can. First of all, when the possession amounts that were involved in the smaller amounts were no longer felonies to be have a sanction that was impactful on the individual, a couple of things happened for us. When doing drug investigations, we like to get the person who doesn't necessarily just have a small amount. We like to see ourselves engaging in a discretionary form of enforcement that helps us to say to an individual who only has a small amount that possibly he's not a big-time dealer, he's probably a user. Can we get you some help? Can you help us get to the point of where this came from so we could put a stop to it in a community? Without sanctions, we found that these people were telling us they weren't interested. There wasn't enough sanction or enough impact on them for them to cooperate. There is issues in their lives where this has taken over their life, like Maslow's hierarchy, and they just rather deal with the consequences, which were so minimal that you would see them either calculating how much time it would be before they were out of your possession or out of your from being an arrest or a citation or something like that. The other thing that happens is on these smaller amounts, we tend to see the same 15-20% of the people engaged in this activity. What we're trying to do is find the strategic amounts of controlled substances coming to the area, into the town, into the community, and look at the other things that are quality of life accounts. Most of you have had constituents that have called you and said, hey, we have this issue going on down the street where there's all this traffic going on. And it often was difficult for us to even get back to that house with a small amount of possession in the person that was leaving because they weren't willing to cooperate with us, that we couldn't get to where we needed to be. And it seemed to be almost an institutional, I would say, or a systematic inertia that you had to overcome, because then when you went to prosecution, prosecution didn't have the resources commensurate with whatever the crime was when they had increases in person-on-person crimes and violent crimes. So it went right down the line for us, sir, and it made it difficult for us to actually make an impact on the amount of drugs that was coming in.
We have a follow-up question.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And that's what I began to understand as the feedback came, that the pressure, a felony hanging over a small user would help them get other people. So I get that. But what I need to probably relay and maybe even ask you how this works, once a felony charge is given somebody in a smaller possession, and they go ahead and give some information, and it's bargained down to, say, a misdemeanor, the charge of the felony still stays, and so it starts to ramp up for the individual without a remedy to that individual. And I think that's what we're trying to get to in some of our reform measures, is how do we get that person turned? Once they become a felony charged person, that becomes problematic. And so have you seen that play out, or are we just hearing anecdotally inappropriate information?
Robert Hinshaw.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, it's hard for me to make a determination on that based on how we try to do these things. We're often looking at a person who is a small-time user, and the best thing that we can do is get that person into some form of treatment. What we make a negotiation process is we do not do that solely on our own. We engage the defense attorney, not the defense attorney, but the prosecuting attorney in those things, because we don't make promises to people on what we're going to do and what we don't do. The discretion for us was when you're going to charge a person, and if that person decides to cooperate, it's usually a concerted effort between a prosecutor and an investigator, whether a local police department or a state trooper. So that would be hard for me to gauge on what the impact to the individual is. But oftentimes, as I was saying before, is we have to decide on getting the large amounts and also trying to have those social impacts that are positive for the community that keep a person being able to let their child run up and down the road on their bicycle because the traffic has been tamped down and we were able to do something about it, or the parking lot at the grocery store where you see a lot of these complaints come from. Us actually targeting those individuals became difficult for us, and we had to go after larger amounts in order for us to at least find some impact that we could stem some of the tides. Before we used to go and maybe find a lower person and work our way up, and the cases that we started working were mostly about the trafficking and the importation, which didn't allow us to look at the what we call the quality of life issues for the surrounding community and the neighborhoods and the people that live there. So long story short, it was always a deal in this situation when we're doing these drug investigations, no matter who we're talking to, any of those negotiations take place with the help of a prosecutor. And prior to 91, that help of a prosecutor also gave us a discretion to be able to get to those places we needed to do to make an impact on the amount of drugs that were coming.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, totally get that. And I just wanted to make it abundantly clear that we're charging somebody with a felony so that we can get to people who are doing felonious work. And I understand the tool and why they have to have that, but the people generally are not doing felonious behavior unless we say they are. And so I think the commission was talking about how do we turn them at that point. And we just missed that particular tool of getting them off the street. But what we have to do now, I think, is we have to figure out, okay, if we're going to put a felony over you, how do we get you to move beyond that? And so we tried suspended entry of judgment and a few things like that. So I'm just going to hold my powder on this one as we look at that, because I agree that we're using downward pressure of a felony to make somebody help us get the bad actors and get these guys off the street. So that is the right tool. But like he said, we disregard the life of those that we're holding a felony over. And so that's part of the conundrum we find ourselves in. So it's just to let you know.
Think about it and see what you come up with. We're going to switch over to Senator Chickie. He's been waiting for a while. So Senator Chickie, go ahead.
Well, I just look at it a different way, and I hear what you're saying, which is one of the reasons I supported 91, but it just simply isn't working. And the drug house issue, I know the impacts in my community, and I've talked to the troopers, and their hands are just tied. The other thing we're not thinking about is the user-dealer. I mean, a very high proportion of first-time users are through a user-dealer. That would be amounts that we wouldn't think of arresting as a dealer, because it may just be they sell one out of every two hits that they purchase, right? Yet they're introducing new users, and you know what, I mean, we're talking about an average of 10 years for someone to come clean after becoming addicted. So I don't think you have a choice, and I do hope we'll see more use of suspended imposition of sentence and entry of judgment to try to negotiate with these lower-level users and turn their lives around. But in the meantime, if you don't have that stick, the carrot's not going to work either. They're not even interested in the carrot without the stick. So I think it's the right way to go, and I support it. And I just wanted to comment, this would be for Mr. Duxbury as well. So we had crime meetings in my community with law enforcement and community members that were adversely affected, and the disorderly conduct change was a big deal to them. They saw disorderly conduct, being able to hold someone sometimes would be often disorderly conduct is sort of a precursor to domestic violence if someone is just really on a kind of bender. Do you have comments as to why Section 28 is in the bill and why that is so important on increasing the disorderly conduct from the 24-hour max to the 0 to 10-day?
Senator Michicki, through the chair. One of the things that you make note of is, and we've heard it discussed about what worked before 91 and what worked after 91, what isn't, what is. We see the same 15 to 20% re-victimizing people over and over and over again. what happens when you take them out of the population and you give them some time to get out of the population and not be able to re-victimize. It's almost as if a cooling down period. And, of course, this is anecdotal for us, but it is one of the things that we noticed, the revolving door of before you get convicted of anything, that you just keep coming in and keep going through the revolving door was something that was significant. I think people saw that is when you can get somebody out of the population, and if it's that 10 to 15, 20% that nothing's been working on, at least getting them out of the population for a period of time had a tendency to slow down the process, give them something to think about, and then maybe restart them with a better situation after they've slowed down.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just a follow-up. So back off of the disorderly conduct issue and back onto the small quantities of drug possession. I met with a lot of people over the last year and a half, and a common theme that I heard from folks that did turn their life around it actually wasn't until they had a significant charge that they kind of realized how far they had gone downhill. They'd gotten past the point of where their family was, you know, bailing them out any longer. It had gotten serious enough. They, in some cases, landed a felony charge, and that was kind of the alarm that went off that got them to say, I'm either going to die or I'm going to spend the rest of my life in jail. It's time. And that's why I think you have to combine the carrot of treatment with the threat of a felony that sticks. And I do hope that prosecutors will use those other tools on the first timers to try to turn their lives around.
I'm going to add a comment to that. I thought it was interesting. Both of you, Senator Coggin and Machicki, you're making here, but with Mr. Duxbury made it, which is if we don't have the tools available to get them into the system from what they see on the street, they don't have the ability to get them help. And the law enforcement officers often know them up front because they're in the local community. And when they know that the perpetrators, like you said, the same people over and over and over again, if we can get them the tools they need to get them in and get the help, perhaps we can prevent the cycle from repeating. So, Senator Cargill.
And what we heard from the police was they only have one thing they can do. They can pick a guy up or gal up and take him to jail. There's not enough treatment facilities out there. Even if they could divert them, chances are they couldn't divert them that day. So I tend to agree, but I wanted to vet this a little bit because mm-hmm. I think it's important to understand that you're charging somebody to make something else happen, and that charge then follows them the rest of their life, generally speaking. And we were trying to avoid that. But what we did inadvertently was we created this conundrum where they couldn't get them and change their behavior. So I think the police felt really hamstrung because if they couldn't take them off the street, or if they did, they would bounce right back out. You know, the point you made, Senator Machicki, was good, and the police have some real – I mean, they can only take them so many places, right? And they put them in a squad car, and then they take them to jail. So I understand that, but I wanted it to be abundantly clear that we're charging somebody something to do something else. And I think that needs to be very, very clear as what we're going forward here, that's a pretty heavy hammer, that if it's the only tool we have, I get it. But I just wanted people to understand that's why we're doing this.
Is this Sam Machicki fellow?
I think that might be the only place where we disagree just a little bit because I think if you arrest someone for a small quantity of drugs, they may or may not be a user dealer introducing new young people to heroin or meth or something else. And if the arresting officer is perhaps arresting them with heroin and meth, they may not know about the four chainsaws they sold to buy those drugs or the gun that they stole from a relative the night before. I mean, I think the only way you're going to get a hold of this is for there to be consequences because you don't know about all the other behaviors. You just know somehow they're funding that habit and they're likely spreading that habit to others. So I think they're spreading the habit, which you may not know with quantities that a user dealer carries. I mean, I've just been reading more and more about that without a pretty substantial impact, you may never change that behavior. So again, if it's truly a first-timer with a small quantity, I hope they do use those tools of suspending entry and give them another chance. If it's not, I think it is felonious behavior and they should pay the price.
Mr. Chairman, that's not what we're saying in the statute, though. What we're saying in the statute is the first time this level. And so I think it's just to be clear, it is probably what he says is socially true, but not legally true. And so that's one of the struggles we have to deal with down here. We don't always have a good scale to operate under. So I think the testimony is important, though, that the thievery quite often is involved in the drug use. I mean, it's just that's part of the problem that the police had with some of the lower thresholds and of the drug use and the issue on disorderly conduct. All that fell into it. It's just that as we describe it in a law, we're talking about first time, and so that's why you have to be clear about what you're saying and clear about what you mean what you say. So
if it was easy, we wouldn't have committee meetings endlessly all day every day, so we'd be done and out of here in no time. And I expected this gentleman, we knew this was going to be a long bill with a lot of questions, and we are going to focus most of our time for the next week and a half. The questions we're going to be digging. We have one more that we'll get to here in a moment, but just in the interest of time, I'm going to throw out, without extending us past this much, Section 27 for the Department of Law or Public Safety, where we talk about the terroristic threats. I have some problems with the language there, and I'm going to ask you to be prepared to speak a little more to that on Thursday. And also, as we get into the DNA section about DNA swabbing and the personal privacy issues, I think that brings up. So I just want you to be prepared that I'm going to dive pretty hard on those. So be prepared to discuss that for sure. There's obviously other questions you have in front of us from various committee members, so be prepared to go through those. Like I said, this was going to be a slog. We knew it. And we're going to let these questions go back and forth. That's how we're going to get to some answers. So, but in the interest of time, I'm going to stop it there for the day.
Can I throw one in to prepare there, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'd ask all of you that real quick. If you have one or two topic areas that you really want them to dig by Thursday and have them prepared, please do. And I would throw as well to DOC one more on the drugs. If you have any data available, ladies, that shows when we went and we reduced the drug possession felonies from what we had kind of pre and post over the last few years, that might be helpful as well, just like the chart we asked Mr. Henderson to prepare, if he could tell us that. And that might give us and I'm asking that for two reasons. One, what we think we're going to expect, and as we're changing potentially these crime laws, we're discussing DOC budget and what we have for room available and how we're moving, you know, the system around with potentially closing and not closing facilities. I'd like to know what numbers we might see coming our way. So we're kind of looking at that general trend item, please. So that being said, Senator Machicki, you asked first, so go ahead.
Yeah, the two I talked about clarifying that the behavior that's legal in AS-17 with marijuana, and we will clarify that, do not pertain to the changes to Title 11. We don't want to incriminate people for what is perfectly legal in the state of Alaska right now. But the questions I'm really going to have, and this came up in my community crime meetings with law enforcement, is the revoked license issue. I'm going to be looking for a way to either legally separate revoked from suspended. And if that's not possible, I would like to evaluate returning revoked and suspended as an arrestable offense. And that is that's just been a clear case with a lot of the drug cases and the theft cases where there's just nothing they can do to search the vehicle that in some cases they know is or have a pretty high level of suspicion that the vehicle also has drugs and perhaps stolen items in that vehicle. So I'd like to ask those questions on the constitutionality of separating them, and if not, I'd like to have the discussion about returning both to an arrestable offense.
Okay. Senator Kawasaki, I think you shook your head like you might have a few specific topics.
Just these.
Copy that. And Senator Coghill, any areas you'd like to focus on Thursday? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside at this time. That concludes our business for today. Senate State Affairs will be meeting again this coming Thursday, April 11, 2019 at 3:30 back in this room. We will get an initial rollout of Senate Bill 80, Initiative Severability by Senator Birch. Then we're going to get back into SB 32. I just will mention this, gentlemen, just for the record right now, as I was trying to get up support for this next Wednesday night, the last one, of the session. We're going to do evening testimony from 6 to 8 p.m. and one more time. I know people shake their heads, and that'll be it. And I will ask that also by next Wednesday night, close of business, any amendments you have for SB 32, and we'll try to get this done if we can. So that'll be it, and then we'll bring, like I said, back up SB 32. Seeing no other business before the committee, we're going to adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:05 p.m.